Chapter 28, The Evidence of Gargantuan Boat.
Even though God had clearly established his leadership for his people, this guy and his followers thought they knew better. They thought they knew better than God, you see, they didn't like the way things were going, let alone the direction they were headed, and so they decided to take matters into their own hands. And so they came to the leadership and opposed them by saying, "Who do you think you are, setting yourselves above the people of God? We're all holy. The Lord is with us. You have gone too far." So the existing leadership just simply put it back in God's hands, saying, "In the morning the Lord will show to you who belongs to him and who is holy, and he will have that person come near to him. It is you who have gone too far." And sure enough, the next morning they all showed up, both sides, and stood before the Lord. Well, immediately, the Lord spoke to his existing leadership and warned them, saying, "Separate yourselves from this assembly so I can put an end to them at once." Then, in an amazing act of humility, the leadership actually fell face down before the Lord and interceded for the people, saying, "O God, God of the spirits of all mankind, will you be angry with the entire assembly when only one man sins?" And so the Lord replied, "All right, say to the people, move away from these rebellious wicked men or they too will be swept away because of their sins." So the people obviously moved away from these men, and sure enough, the Lord acted quickly. All of a sudden, the ground split apart, the earth actually opened its mouth, and they, along with all their families and all their possessions, were actually swallowed whole. They went down alive into the grave itself, putting an end once and for all to their upstart rebellion. The book is Numbers. The judgment, of course, is Korah's rebellion.
Now, folks, how many of you guys remember the account of Korah's rebellion and the price they paid for their insurrection? Aha! It cost them their life, didn't it? And here's my point. If we're honest with ourselves, most of us are thinking something like, "Gee, was God." Don't you think that's a little harsh there? I mean, come on. It was just a little act of rebellion. What's the big deal? And people, that's precisely the problem. When are we going to learn that God does not mess around with sin? No matter the size you want to size it, or color you want to give it, it's still sin. And one day when you least expect it, God is going to judge it. Therefore, here's the point. You would think that people would stand up and take notice when God warns them about another future coming judgment, right? You would think that people would rightly conclude, "Hey man, I better get right with God so I don't suffer the coming judgment of God," right? But unfortunately, folks, as we've been seeing, that's no longer the case. Many people in our world today are not just having a hard time believing in God, but if there's one thing they absolutely refuse to believe in, it's in a future coming judgment of God. Therefore, in order to help these scoffing people hopefully become smarter people, we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And what we're doing is taking a look at the five different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that he's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with the creator of the universe, before it's too late. And so far we've seen the first evidence showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. The second evidence was the evidence of a young creation. The third evidence was the evidence of a special creation. And the last five times we saw the fourth evidence was the evidence of a judged creation. And what we've been seeing is there really was a global catastrophe, i.e. a worldwide flood, a time when God judged this world, not just because the Bible says so, but as we saw last time, because even the evidence of a galloping runoff says so. And what we saw it was the evidences of rapid water, rapid erosion, and even rapid modern-day examples, i.e. Mount St. Helens, that showed us beyond a shadow of a doubt, contrary to what the skeptics say, that the topography of the Earth, including the Grand Canyon, is not a result of millions and billions of years of evolution. Are you kidding me? It's the leftover remnants of God's first judgment upon sin. Therefore, as we saw, there is no reason to scoff at the Bible. There's no reason to be willingly ignorant. There's tons of evidence that God judged this world once, and he's getting ready to do it again. And the point is, you better get ready. But you might be thinking, okay, so it's quite obvious with all the geological evidence throughout the earth that there really was a global flood that covered the earth. But what about this Noah guy? How do we know he was for real and not a myth? And what about this ark thingy that supposedly carried all the survivors of this flood? Is there any evidence that this guy and his ark even existed? Of course. And that brings us to the sixth evidence of a judged creation is the evidence of a gargantuan boat.
Genesis 6:12-22. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms, and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it: the length of the ark 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second and third decks. Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth, to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life, from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark, to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them." Thus Noah did, according to all that God had commanded him, so he did.
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible is clear. God not only forewarned Noah that he was going to judge the earth because of its sin, but he also commanded Noah to build a boat for he and his family to get in, right? And notice it wasn't just a boat. It was a huge gargantuan boat. So big that it could carry not one but two of every kind of animal. That's a big boat. But again, you might be thinking, okay, that's nice and neat that the Bible says that Noah and his giant ark thingy was real, but again, is there any evidence outside the Bible that this guy and his ark even existed, let alone was even feasible? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence showing that there really was a gargantuan boat is the finding of the ark. You see, the Bible is not the only place we find evidence of a guy named Noah building a big old giant boat. Many people throughout history have claimed to have found the remains of this boat. And it's not just recent history either. Just as one would expect, some of these findings have occurred long before the time of Jesus. Let's take a look.
In 257 BC, Berossus, a Chaldean historian, wrote, "But of this ship that grounded in Armenia, some part of it still remains, and some get pitch from the ship by scraping it off and use it for amulets to ward off evil." In 64 BC, Nicholas of Damascus was born, who became a Greek historian, and he wrote, "There is a great mountain in Armenia, over Minuas, called Baris, upon which it is reported that many who fled at the time of the deluge were saved, and that one who was carried in an ark came on shore upon the top of it, and that the remains of the timber were a great while preserved. This might be the man about whom Moses, the legislator of the Jews, wrote." The 1st century Jewish historian Flavius Josephus mentions the remains of Noah's ark three times. He also said, "The Armenians call that spot the landing place, for it was there that the ark came safe to land, and they show the relics of it to this day. This flood and the ark are mentioned by all who have written histories of the barbarians. These matters are also mentioned by Hieronymus the Egyptian, author of the ancient history of Phoenicia, by Narses and by many others, and they are still shown to such as are desirous to see them." In 180 AD, Theophilus of Antioch said, "And of the ark, the remains are to this day to be seen in the Arabian mountains." The 4th century Bishop Epiphanius of Salamis wrote, "Do you seriously suppose that we are unable to prove our point, when even to this day the remains of Noah's ark are shown in the country of the Kurds? Why, were one to search diligently, doubtless one would also find at the foot of the mountain the remnants of the altar where Noah, on leaving the ark, tarried to offer clean and fatly animals as a sacrifice to the Lord God." The 4th century John Chrysostom said, "Do not the mountains of Armenia testify to it, where the ark rested? And are not the remains of the ark preserved there to this very day for our admonition?" In 610 AD, Isidore of Seville wrote, "Ararat is a mountain in Armenia, where the historians testify that the ark came to rest after the flood. So even to this day wood remains of it are to be seen there." In 620 AD, Roman Byzantine Emperor Heraclius is reported to have visited the remains of the ark after conquering a city in Persia. In 1245 AD, Gion Hathan, a monk, wrote, "Upon the snows of Ararat a black speck is visible at all times. This is Noah's ark. In the 14th century, Marco Polo wrote that the Ark was reported to be on a very high mountain in central Armenia. In 1633 AD, Adam Olearius, a German scholar, wrote, "The Armenians, and the Persians themselves, are of opinion that there are still upon the said mountain some remainders of the Ark, but that time hath so hardened them, that they seem absolutely petrified." At Skimaki in Media Persia, we were shown a cross of a blackened hardwood, which the inhabitants affirmed to have been made of the wood of the Ark. In 1829, Dr. Friedrich Parrott, who had made an ascent of Greater Ararat, wrote in his journey to Ararat that all Armenians are firmly persuaded that Noah's Ark remains to this very day on the top of Ararat, and that, in order to preserve it, no human being is allowed to approach it. In 1856 AD, Haji Yerim said, "It was an unusually hot summer, so the snow and glaciers had melted more than usual. The Armenians were very reticent to undertake any expedition to the Ark because they feared God's displeasure, but the father of Haji thought that possibly the time had come when God wanted the world to know the Ark was still there, and he wanted to prove to those atheists that the Bible story of the flood and the Ark is true. They went inside the Ark and did considerable exploring. It was divided up into many floors and stages and compartments and had bars like animal cages of today. The whole structure was covered with a varnish or lacquer that was very thick and strong, both outside and inside the ship. The ship was built more like a great and mighty house on the hull of a ship. There was a great doorway of immense size, but the door was missing. The scientists were appalled and dumbfounded and went into a satanic rage at finding what they hoped to prove non-existent. They were so angry and mad that they said they would destroy the ship, but the wood was more like stone than any wood we have now. They did not have tools or means to wreck so mighty a ship, and had to give up. They did tear out some timbers and tried to burn the wood, but it was so hard it was almost impossible to burn it. They held a council, and then took a solemn and fearful death oath. Any man present who would ever breathe a word about what they had found would be tortured and murdered." In 1915, just before Haji died at 75 years old, he told his story. In 1918, on his deathbed, one of the three atheists told his story, which matched in every detail. In 1876, Sir James Bryce, a noted British scholar, climbed Ararat and found, at the 13,000-foot level, 2,000 feet above the timberline, a piece of hand-tooled wood, 4 feet long, that he believed might be from the Ark. In 1883 AD, Turkish scientists, soldiers, and a British diplomat, Captain Gascoigne, investigated an earthquake on Ararat. At last they were rewarded by the sight of a huge dark mass, protruding 20 or 30 feet from the glacier, on the left side of the ravine. It was in a good state of preservation, being painted on the outside with a dark brown pigment, and constructed of great strength. The explorers found it filled for the greater part with ice, the interior being partitioned off into compartments about 12 or 15 feet high. In 1908, George Hagopian, an Armenian immigrant, said, "The Ark was resting on a huge rock, bluish-green in color, but one side was on the edge of a steep cliff. The mountain was impossible to climb from the side. When he looked over the edge, he could hardly see the bottom of the mist. The Ark was very long and rectangular. Parts of the bottom were exposed, and he could see that it was flat. The roof was nearly flat, except for a row of windows, 50 or more, estimated size 18 inches by 30 inches, running from front to back, covered by an overhanging roof. The front was also flat. The side tipped out a little from the bottom to top. The wood appeared to be entirely petrified." In 1916, a Russian pilot flying over Ararat in World War I thought he saw the Ark. News of his discovery reached the Tsar, who sent two large expeditions to the site. The soldiers found and explored the boat, but before they could report to the Tsar, the Russian Revolution of 1917 began. Their report disappeared, and the soldiers scattered. In July 1943, Ed Davis, a sergeant in the U.S. Army, was stationed in Iran. There he developed a close friendship with some Lur tribesmen who said they knew the location of Noah's Ark. The Lurs are related to the Kurds. When Davis asked to see the Ark, they first took him to their village. There Davis claims he saw items from the Ark: a cage door, latches, a metal hammer, dried beans, shepherd staffs, oil lamps, bowls, and pottery jars still containing honey. This Muslim tribe considered it a religious duty to prevent outsiders from seeing the Ark, even if killing was necessary. However, their close friendship with Davis made him an exception. In 1948, a Kurdish farmer named Resit said, "The prow of a ship protruding into a canyon was seen. The prow was almost entirely revealed, but the rest of the object still was covered. In 1953, George Green, an oil geologist, photographed the Ark from a helicopter and described it as lying generally in a north-south direction, situated seemingly on a large rock bench or shelf on the side of a vertical rock cliff at the 13,000 to 14,000 feet level. His photos disappeared in British Guiana when he was murdered there in 1962. In the late 1950s, Gregor Schwinghammer claims he saw the Ark from an F-100 aircraft while assigned to the 428th Tactical Fighter Squadron based in Adana, Turkey. Schwinghammer said it looked like an enormous boxcar lying in a gully high up on Mount Ararat. He said U-2 pilots had photographed it. In 1949, the Ararat anomaly was first photographed by a fixed-wing aircraft in 1949 and later by a U-2 in 1956. Satellites photographed it in 1973, 1976, 1990, and 1992. Some of the low-resolution 1949 photographs have been released to the public, thanks to the efforts of law professor Portia Taylor. In 1999 and 2000, private funds paid for the best private sector satellite, Iconos, to photograph the object at a resolution of 3 feet. Some CIA photographs had a 6-inch resolution, enough magnification to see a soccer ball from space. The Defense Intelligence Agency did not rule out the possibility that it could be a man-made object. In 1986, tribal leader Arbus Arbus and his 7 sons took Ed Davis on another journey to see the Ark. Steep, slick rocks, made worse by cold rain, prevented them from getting closer than 1/2 mile from the Ark. 2 broken portions of the Ark, lying on their sides and 1/3 of a mile apart, were visible during moments when fog and clouds lifted. Wooden beams, 3 decks, and rooms were seen. Arbus Arbus told Davis other details. The Ark's wood was extremely hard, wooden pegs were used in its construction instead of nails, its large, side door opened from the bottom outward, like a garage door, and the human quarters consisted of 48 compartments in the middle of the top deck. In 1986, several dozen Ark researchers questioned Davis extensively, and in 1989 he passed a lie detector test. In June 2006, Bob Cornuke of the Bible Archaeology Search and Exploration Institute took a team of 14 American business, law, and ministry leaders to visit a site purported to be a possible resting place of the Ark. The team claimed to have discovered an object 13,000 feet above sea level, which had the appearance of blackened petrified wooden beams, and was about the size of a small aircraft carrier and was consistent with the dimensions provided in the Book of Genesis. The team also reported to have found fossilized sea creatures inside the petrified wood, and in the immediate vicinity of the site. In 2007, a joint Turkish-Hong Kong expedition claimed to find an unusual cave with fossilized wooden walls on Mount Ararat, well above the vegetation line. This 2007 expedition marked the first time in history that an alleged material sample of Noah's Ark was retrieved for lab analysis. The sample was determined by the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Hong Kong to be petrified wood, although the origin of the material remains uncertain.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but it sure appears to me that there's plenty of evidence outside the Bible of findings of the Ark. How about you? And keep in mind, that's not all of them. Why, if I didn't know any better, I'd say there's plenty of evidence that there really was a guy named Noah who really did have a gargantuan boat. How about you? Oh, but that's not all. The second evidence showing that there really was a gargantuan boat is the feasibility of the Ark. You see, you might be thinking, okay, that's nice and neat that there's plenty of evidence outside the Bible confirming the findings of the Ark, but what about the feasibility of the Ark? I mean, is it even possible for a guy back then to build a boat that big, let alone one big enough to hold 2 of every kind of animal? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence showing that this gargantuan boat really was feasible is the design requirements.
Genesis 6:14-16. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood, you shall make the ark with rooms, and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it: the length of the ark 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks.
Now, it's from this text and others that we learn several important details about the feasibility of Noah's Ark. They are as follows.
Number 1, the Ark was a giant rectangular barge constructed of gopher wood and covered with pitch. Number 2, it was 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high, or approximately 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Number 3, it had 3 stories. Number 4, it had a door in the side with a window in the roof. Number 5, most likely it was built over a period of 100 years. Number 6, it was intended to preserve the righteous people and 2 of every kind of air-breathing land animals from the flood, which God was about to bring over the earth. Number 7. God brought the animals to Noah, the family did not have to go get them. Number 8. When the door closed, only 8 people had boarded, Noah and wife, plus his 3 sons and their wives. Number 9. Everyone else rejected God's protection. Number 10. The overall size of the ark makes it the largest sea-going vessel known before the 20th century, and its proportions are amazingly similar to the large ocean liners of today.
And so that becomes the logical question. If a boat really were of that size, could the thing have even been seaworthy, let alone survive a worldwide flood? Well, as one person stated,
somebody knew what they were doing when they came up with the dimensions, or design, of Noah's Ark.
It is now known, based on the Ark's specific dimensions, that it had total stability, comfort, and strength. Had the Ark been taller, it could become unstable. Had it been longer, it could have broken in two. And if it was either wider or shorter, it would have become dangerously uncomfortable. In fact, modern shipbuilders say it would have been almost impossible to turn over. They believe it was completely suited for riding out the tremendous storms in a year-long flood. Furthermore, recently some Korean scientists decided to put the Ark's design to the test. The world-class ship researcher center in Korea, CRISO, analyzed the biblical proportions and found Noah's Ark to strike an amazing balance between the conflicting requirements for stability, comfort, and strength of a seagoing vessel.
Starting with the proportions given in the Bible, the CRISO team set about to compare it with 12 alternative arcs with different proportions. By combining the requirements for stability, capsize resistance, comfort, sea kindliness, and strength, hull stress, they found that it was not possible to make much improvement on the biblical Arkansas. They assumed a random sea, where the waves came from all directions with the same probability. The Korean tests showed that Noah's Ark had among the best proportions possible. The study was headed by Dr. S.W. Hong, who was principal research scientist at CRISO at the time. He listed the Noah's Ark study alongside other research papers on the company website until as recently as 2006. The study is rather clinical, but it certainly answers any skeptic who would claim Noah's Ark is not a feasible wooden vessel.
The second evidence showing that this gargantuan boat really was feasible is the space requirements. Now maybe you're thinking, okay, so maybe the design of the Ark proves that it was an amazing, totally seaworthy vessel. But there's no way it could hold 2 of every kind of animal. Really? Well, first of all, Noah didn't need to take along the water-breathing creatures. This would have seriously reduced the amount of space need for the animals, as this gentleman states.
According to Ernest Mayer, America's leading taxonomist, there are over 1 million species of animals in the world. However, the vast majority of these are capable of surviving in water and would not need to be brought aboard the Ark. Noah need make no provision for the 21,000 species of fish or the 1,700 tunicates, marine chordates like sea squirts, found throughout the seas of the world, or the 600 echinoderms including starfish and sea urchins, or the 107,000 mollusks such as mussels, clams and oysters, or the 10,000 coelenterates like corals and sea anemones, jellyfish and hydroids, or the 5,000 species of sponges, or the 30,000 protozoans, the microscopic single-celled creatures. In addition, some of the mammals are aquatic. For example, the whales, seals and porpoises. The amphibians need not all have been included, nor all the reptiles, such as sea turtles and alligators. Moreover, a large number of the arthropods numbering 838,000 species, such as lobsters, shrimp, crabs and water fleas and barnacles, are marine creatures. And the insect species among arthropoda are usually very small. Also, many of the 35,000 species of worms, as well as many of the insects, could have survived outside the Arkansas.
Also, keep in mind that God said 2 of every kind of animal and not 2 of every species of animals. This too would immediately reduce the amount of space needed to hold all these animals. Noah didn't need 2 of each dog species, that would be a ton of dogs. He only needed 2 of the dog kind, a male and a female, that's only 2. From those two original dogs came all the different species of dogs today. And remember, if you think that's a little hard to believe, even though it doesn't take very many generations for two dogs to produce all kinds of dogs, big, small, tall, short, etc., would you please consider what evolution teaches? They teach that not just dogs but all the animals as well as all the people as well as all the plants came from a rock. Do they not teach that it supposedly rained on the rocks for millions of years and this supposedly produced a primordial soup that supposedly got hit by lightning and voila, all of life appeared on the scene? No thank you. I think I'll stick to two dogs on an ark. I don't have enough faith to believe in evolution. However, I have to admit that two of every kind is still a lot of animals. And so that's the question. Could Noah's Ark contain even space to hold all these animals? Of course. Let's do the math. First of all, the Ark was a barge, not a ship with sloping sides, so it had a larger carrying capacity. If you do the math, the Ark would have been so huge that the total available floor space on the Ark would have been over 100,000 square feet, which would be more floor space than in 20 standard-sized basketball courts. Assuming an 18-inch cubit, Noah's Ark would have had a total cubic volume would have been 1,518,000 cubic feet that would be equal to the capacity of 569 modern railroad stock cars. Now that's a huge amount of space. But still, is it enough to hold two of every kind of air-breathing animal? Of course. In fact, there would actually be a ton of room to spare as these researchers discovered. Researchers discovered that on the high side, no more than 35,000 individual animals needed to go on the Ark. Others would say, on the low side that as few as 2,000 animals may have been required on the Ark. But they decided to pad this number for error, and showed that the Ark could easily accommodate 16,000 animals. But then they decided to be generous and pad this number even more to include extinct animals. Then they even added on some more just to satisfy even the most skeptical. They assumed an incredibly high number of 50,000 animals on the Ark, far more animals than required, were on board the Ark, and these need not have been the largest or even adult specimens, since the average animal is about the size of a sheep and only a few animals are very large, such as the dinosaur or the elephant, which even these could be represented by much smaller younger ones. They used the railroad car for comparison and noted that the average double-deck stock car can accommodate 240 sheep. Thus, three trains hauling about 69 cars each would have ample space to carry the 50,000 animals, filling only 37% of the Ark. This would leave about 362 cars or enough to make over five trains of 72 cars each to carry all of the food and baggage plus Noah's family of eight people. Also, keep in mind that these dimensions are based on the Hebrew cubit. If when Moses was writing the Genesis account he had in mind the larger Egyptian cubit, this would make this gargantuan boat even bigger. Either way, these findings clearly showed that the Ark had plenty of space requirements. The third evidence showing that this gargantuan boat really was feasible is the care requirements. But maybe you're thinking, okay, so maybe two of every kind of air-breathing animals could have fit on the Ark with even room to spare. But just how feasible was it for one guy and his family to care for all these animals, let alone for over a year? Well, the first way we know the animals' care requirements were totally feasible is the air requirements. Many people will rightly ask, how in the world did all those animals breathe on that Ark? This is because as we see in some modern, mass animal housing used for food, breathing is such an issue that they have to provide adequate ventilation. Well, first of all, the density of animals on the Ark, compared to the volume of enclosed space in these modern scenarios was much less, but remember the design of the Ark. It had a window along the top center section, which wasn't there for viewing, but for ventilating. It is also interesting to note that the convective movement of air, driven by temperature differences between the warm-blooded animals and the cold interior surfaces, would have been significant enough to drive the flow of air even further. However, if supplementary ventilation was necessary, it could have been provided by wave motion, fire thermal, or even a small number of animals harnessed to slow-moving rotary fans. The second way we know the animals' care requirements were totally feasible is the food requirements. Oh, but air is not the only thing these animals would need. They would obviously need food, over a year's supply of it. So how did Noah provide for that? Well, first of all, the Bible records that all animals and people were vegetarians before and during the flood.
Genesis 1 29-30. Then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the sky and to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food, and it was so."
Therefore, the ark would probably have carried compressed and dried foodstuffs, and probably a lot of concentrated food. Perhaps Noah fed the animals mainly on grain, plus some hay for fiber. Researchers have calculated that the volume of foodstuffs would have been only about 15% of the ark's total volume, and drinking water would only have taken up 9.4% of the volume. This is still plenty of room, for the animals at high estimates only take up 37% of the ark. Also, the volume for water would be reduced even further if rainwater was collected and piped into troughs. Furthermore, the three levels would improve access to food storage, utilizing gravity to supply grain and water to the animal enclosures below. Water could be directed in pipes, metal, wood, leather, bamboo, etc., from tanks on upper levels. The use of some sort of self-feeders would have been relatively easy and probably essential. Again, Noah was a smart guy, and he probably realized that in order to pull this off, he and his family needed to work smarter, not harder. The third way we know the animals' care requirements were totally feasible is the waste requirements. Speaking of food, another question people ask is, okay then, what did Noah do with all the waste products the animals produced? You talk about a full-time job. And if you were to say that, you would be right. It is estimated that there may have been as much as 12 tons of animal waste produced every day on the ark. So how did Noah and his family keep up with this? Well, Noah was a smart guy, and he probably figured out that he not only needed to design a way to keep the ark clean, but to design it in such a way so as he and his family didn't need to do all the work. In other words, it might have very well been an automated procedure like we use today. For instance, Noah could have used sloped, self-cleaning floors, emptying into a manure gutter or pit. Then the family could have then dumped this overboard without an excessive expenditure of manpower. After all, there's plenty of water around. He could have disposed of the waste using vermicomposting, composting by worms. He could have also designed a system that would prevent the need to change animal bedding. He could have allowed the waste to accumulate below the animals, much as we see in modern pet shops, in slatted floors. Small animals, such as birds, could have multiple levels in their enclosures, and waste could have simply accumulated at the bottom of each. Very deep bedding can sometimes last for a year without needing a change. Absorbent material, for example sawdust, softwood wood shavings, and especially peat moss, would reduce the moisture content and hence the odor. Speaking of which, the problem of toxic or explosive manure gases, such as methane, could have been alleviated by the constant movement of the ark, which would have allowed manure gases to be constantly released. Also, methane, which is half the density of air, would quickly find its way out of a small opening such as a window, which the ark had. Thus, there is no reason to believe that the levels of these gases within the ark would have ever even approached hazardous levels. Also, the central skylight in the ark would help provide not only the ventilation but the lighting as well. Granted, the voyage of the ark may not have been comfortable or easy, especially with all this animal care, but it was certainly doable. Besides, Noah wasn't on a pleasure cruise. He was just trying to survive. The fourth way we know the animals' care requirements were totally feasible is the hibernation requirements. It is also a known fact that when stormy weather hits, animals will hibernate or sleep it out. And a worldwide flood was the biggest storm ever. Thus, when this inactivity and hibernation set in, it would further drastically reduce the need for food and constant care of animals in non-stormy circumstances. In fact, maybe even these hibernation abilities were supernaturally intensified during this period by God. Either way, it's obvious, with their bodily functions reduced to a minimum, the burden of their care would have been greatly lightened. Now folks, I don't know about you, but it sure appears to me that this gargantuan boat was totally feasible to hold and care for two of every kind of animal. How about you? Oh, but that's still not all. The third evidence showing that there really was a gargantuan boat is the further questions surrounding the ark. You see, if there really was a gargantuan boat called Noah's Ark, then questions concerning its location, size, feasibility not only need to be answered, but a whole bunch of other questions surrounding the ark need to be answered as well. And the first question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is, how did the animals get to the ark? Skeptics will try to paint a picture of Noah going to countries all around the world to gather the animals, such as kangaroos and koalas from Australia, and kiwis from New Zealand. However, the Bible states that the animals came to Noah. He did not have to round them up.
Genesis 6:18-20. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark, to keep them alive with you, they shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive.
Also, speaking of animals down under, we also do not know what the geography of the world was like before the flood. If there was only one continent at that time, or if there were land bridges connecting the continents, then there's not a problem of getting animals from one remote region of the world to the ark. Either way, God was in charge if he could cause a worldwide flood to come upon the world. I seriously doubt he would have any problem getting the animals to the ark from around the world. This would help explain the next question. The second question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is, how did the insects get to the ark? Well, first of all, Noah was commanded to take into the ark all the animals on land in whose nostrils was the breath of life.
Genesis 6:17. Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth, to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life, from under heaven, everything that is on the earth shall perish. Genesis 7:15 and verses 21-22. So they went into the ark to Noah, by twos of all flesh in which was the breath of life. All flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, and all mankind of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life, died.
Therefore, many researchers believe that all the varieties of insects we see today weren't even necessarily on the ark. This is because insects breathe through their skin and do not have nostrils. Besides, they could have easily survived on floating matter or by burrowing in the mud. Or, some of the insects may have been on the ark in the fur of the animals or in nooks and crannies of the ark, but the Bible does not teach that they had to be on board. Either way, the continuing population of insects would have been taken care of. The third question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is, how did the animals get dispersed after the flood? Many people will often object to the biblical account of the flood because they say there's no way that the animals could have been dispersed all over the world, especially such areas like Australia or certain islands that don't currently connect with the main continents. Well, that's just it. They don't currently connect with the main continents, but maybe after the flood they did. In fact, the evidence shows they most likely were. It is now known that if you lower the water level of the ocean just a bit, the land bridges would connect our existing continents and it would be possible to get just about anywhere you wanted to in the world, including the animals. Many creationists would put the occurrence of the Ice Age shortly following the flood of Noah due to the obvious and drastic planetary and atmospheric changes that occurred as a result, as we previously discussed. Many decades following, as the ice caps began to melt, the ocean levels began to rise, and the once visible land bridges connecting the continents now became submerged. This would explain why certain animals are isolated in certain areas. Prior to the melting, they traveled to an area, and then after the ocean levels rose, these animals were not only trapped, but other animals could not join them. We can see this evidence in the continental shelf and places like the Bering Strait, the Asia to the Americas. Drop the level of water in the oceans and the continents reconnect and appear much larger than today. And this is what many believe is also a part of the meaning of the earth being divided up in the time of Peleg.
Genesis 10:25. Two sons were born to Eber, the name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan.
Some would say that this event occurred on the fourth generation after the flood, where the earth continued to shift, and polar caps began to melt and cause the waters to cover the valleys between the continents, shutting off the land bridges, dividing people as well as animals. However, even if this wasn't the case, we have seen proof of animals having an amazing ability to get to seemingly isolated areas. For instance, when Krakatoa erupted in 1883, the island remnant remained lifeless for some years, but was eventually colonized by a surprising variety of creatures, including not only insects and earthworms, but birds, lizards, snakes, and even a few mammals. One would not have expected some of this surprising array of creatures to have crossed the ocean, but they obviously did. In fact, even more recently it has been documented that iguanas have traveled hundreds of miles between islands in the Caribbean on huge rafts of matted vegetation that was torn off in storms. Either way, animals getting dispersed all over the world after the flood is not a problem. The fourth question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is, how could saltwater and freshwater fish survive the flood? It's only logical to assume that if indeed the whole earth were covered by water in the flood, then there would have been a mixing of fresh and salt waters. So how did saltwater and freshwater fish survive? Well, first of all, we don't know just how salty the sea was before the flood. But even so, many of today's marine organisms are able to survive large changes in salinity with no problem. For example, Starfish can tolerate as low as 16 to 18% of the normal concentration of seawater. Then there are the migratory species of fish we see today that can and do travel between salt and fresh water. We see this with the salmon, striped bass, and Atlantic sturgeon who spawn in fresh water and then mature in salt water. Then there's eels who reproduce in salt water and grow to maturity in freshwater streams and lakes. Also, many families of fish contain both fresh and saltwater species. These include the families of toadfish, carpike, bowfin, sturgeon, herring/anchovy, salmon/trout/pike, catfish, clingfish, stickleback, scorpionfish, and flatfish. This suggests that the ability to tolerate large changes in salinity was present in most fish at the time of the flood. And finally, it has been demonstrated in modern aquariums that fish can adapt if the salinity is changed slowly enough. So as you can see, many of today's species of fish are able to adjust to both freshwater and saltwater with no problems. Therefore, we wouldn't expect any insurmountable problems with freshwater and saltwater fish after the flood. The fifth question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is how could plants survive the flood? It is a well-established fact that many terrestrial seeds can not only survive long periods in water but even long periods of soaking in various concentrations of salt water. In fact, salt water impedes the germination of some species so that the seed lasts better in salt water than fresh water. This was exposed in a recent finding of seeds preserved in a sunken ship.
In a recent UPI release, Sunken Ship Seeds Sprout 350 Years Later, United Press International Release, June 22, 1987, it was reported that seeds soaked for 350 years in salt water muck have successfully germinated. The seeds were recovered recently off Key West, Florida, from the sunken Spanish treasure ship, Mocha, which was known to have gone down in 1622. The ship contained seeds of grape, olive, apricot, and beggar tick, Biden's albs, the last of which germinated to yield 2-inch beggar tick seedlings at the time of the report.
Then, much akin to the insect scenario, other plants could have survived in floating vegetation masses, or on pumice from the volcanic activity. Furthermore, other pieces of many plants are capable of asexual sprouting, and then there's the plants that would have survived as planned food stores on the ark. There also could have been seeds that had attached themselves to animals, and still others could have survived in the stomachs of the bloated, floating carcasses. We do know that plants were regenerating well before Noah and his family even made it out of the ark when an olive leaf was brought back by a dove.
Genesis 8:10-11. So he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark. The dove came to him toward evening, and behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth.
Therefore, as you can readily see, here are many plausible ways plants could have survived the flood. The sixth question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is why couldn't the flood just have been local? Believe it or not, but some people will admit that there really was a guy named Noah who really made a big boat that he and his family and animals survived on, but they will actually say that this flood was just a local one, not a global one. Well, first of all, this denies all the evidence we've seen thus far concerning the global effects of a global flood, but here's even more reasons why Noah's flood was definitely not merely a local flood.
Number 1. All the mountains were covered. The tops of all the high mountains under the entire heavens were at least 20 feet beneath the water's surface, Genesis 7:19-20. It would be absurd to think that a flood covering the highest mountains of the Middle East would not affect the rest of the world. It could not rise to cover the local mountains while leaving the rest of the world untouched. In addition, the waters remained at this awesome mountain covering height for 5 months. Genesis 7:18-24 and chapter 8:1-5. Number 2. Noah could have moved. If the flood were merely local, God could have sent them to a safer part of the world. God warned Noah about the flood 120 years prior to its start. Surely, Noah and his family could have traveled a great distance in that time. He could have just moved. He could have walked to the other side of the mountains and escaped. Traveling just 20 kilometers per day, Noah and his family could have traveled over 3,000 kilometers in 6 months. God could have simply warned Noah to flee, as he did for Lot in Sodom. Number 3. The ark was huge. If the flood was local, the ark was unnecessarily large. Until the first metal ships were constructed in modern times, the ark was the largest ship ever built. Why was the ark big enough to hold all the different kinds of land vertebrate animals in the world? If only Mesopotamian animals were aboard, or only domestic animals, the ark could have been much smaller. Yet, it was big enough to house representative pairs of every created kind of air-breathing, land animal on Earth. It is clear that the ark was necessary to prevent the extinction of all humans and all animals. Therefore, the flood could not be local. Number 4. Humans populated the entire world. After more than 1,600 years of habitation on Earth, the planet's population was surely large, millions or billions. The Bible confirms that, A. Man had multiplied upon the face of the earth, Genesis 6:1, B. Violence and corruption filled the earth, Genesis 6:11-12. The Bible is clear that man could not have existed only in the Mesopotamian region, a region too small to support such a large population, especially considering the natural dispersion effect of a violent society. Number 5. All humans were killed. The Bible clearly teaches that all flesh died, every man, Genesis 7:21. Genesis 9:1 confirms that only Noah's family was saved and that every person living today is descended from his family. If the flood were local, people who did not happen to be living in the vicinity would not have been affected by it. They would have escaped God's judgment on sin. It boggles the mind to believe that, after all those centuries since creation, no one had migrated to other parts or that people living on the periphery of such a local flood would not have moved to the adjoining high ground rather than be drowned. Number 6. All air-breathing, land animals killed. The world's entire population of air-breathing, land animals died, except those taken into the ark, Genesis 7:21, everything on earth, Genesis 6:17, all living creatures of every kind on the earth, Genesis 9:16. If only those animals in a specific geographic location died, it would seem unnecessary for God to protect pairs in the ark for the express purpose of preventing their extinction. If the flood were local, why did God send the animals to the ark to escape death? There would have been other animals to reproduce those kinds even if they had all died in the local area. Or he could have sent them to a non-flooded region. If the flood were local, why would birds have been sent on board? These could simply have winged across to a nearby mountain range. Birds can fly several hundred kilometers in one day. If the flood was local, why would birds have been sent on board? These could simply have winged across to a nearby mountain range. The Bible is clear that all the air-breathing, land animals perished during the flood, except those preserved with Noah from which all modern animals are descended. Number 7. A cataclysm, not a mere flood. Both Hebrew, Old Testament, and Greek, New Testament, use words to describe Noah's flood which are different than the ordinary words for flood. In this way, Noah's flood was represented as a totally unique occurrence. Hebrew, Mabul, Greek, Kataklysmos, Cataclysm. Number 8. God's Rainbow Promise. God promised never again to send a global flood, Genesis 8:21 and chapter 9:8-17. This promise is demonstrated by the symbol of the rainbow, a sign for God's promise to all the earth. The rainbow is a sign to every living creature, mankind and animals. If this promise was not made to all creatures on earth, then God has broken his promise. Local floods have repeatedly killed hundreds and even thousands of humans and animals since Noah's time. There have been huge local floods in recent times, in Bangladesh, for example, where 80% of that country has been inundated, or Europe in 2002. If the flood was local, God would have repeatedly broken his promise never to send such a flood again. Number 9. Why stay in the ark a year? Noah was in the ark for more than a year, not just 40 days, Genesis 8:14. 53 weeks is absurdly long to stay in the ark for a local flood since dry land would have been just over the horizon. After the flood waters had been going down for 4 months, the dove could still find no suitable ground, Genesis 8:9. This does not seem to fit the circumstances for a local flood in which the dove could fly to dry land. However, these situations are consistent if the flood was global. It was more than 7 months before the tops of any mountains became visible. How could they drift around in a local flood for that long without seeing any mountains? Number 10. The whole earth was devastated. God said, "I am surely going to destroy both them, the people, and the earth," Genesis 6:13b. The global extent of the flood is referred to more than 30 times in Genesis 6-9 alone. In Isaiah 54:9, God states, "I swore that the waters of Noah would never again cover the earth." Clearly this implies a universal flood. Number 11. Jesus said the flood was global. The New Testament passages which speak of the flood use universal language. The flood came and took them all away, Jesus, Matthew 24:39. The flood came and destroyed them all, Jesus, Luke 17:27. Did not spare the ancient world, Greek, cosmos, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. All these statements presuppose a global flood, not some localized event. Belief in a worldwide flood, as scripture clearly indicates, has the backing of common sense, science and Christ himself. Are you prepared to call him a liar?
By the way, I wouldn't recommend that. Number 12. The flood was a type of the global judgment to come.
In 2 Peter 3, the coming judgment by fire is likened to the former judgment by water in Noah's flood. Peter delivered a clear global warning, confirming that God created the earth, devastated it by the flood, and will one day destroy it again by fire, 2 Peter 3:5-7. Peter certainly did not mean that just a local area on earth would be burned. Just as the flood was global, so will be the final judgment. Also, if the flood were merely local, then what did Jesus mean when he likened the coming world judgment to the judgment of all men, Matthew 24:37-39, in the days of Noah?
A partial judgment in Noah's day would mean a partial judgment to come.
If the flood was local, people who did not happen to be living in the vicinity would not be affected by it.
They would have escaped God's judgment on sin.
If this happened, what did Christ mean when he likened the coming judgment of all men to the judgment of all men, Matthew 24:37-39, in the days of Noah?
A partial judgment in Noah's day means a partial judgment to come.
People, it is quite obvious that the Bible is clearly speaking of a global event in the text as well as the global evidences as we've already seen. Therefore, to say this flood is merely local denies the global evidence and calls God a liar. I wouldn't recommend that either. The seventh question surrounding the ark that needs to be answered is, where did all the races come from? Well, according to the Bible, all people on earth today are descended from Noah and his wife, his three sons and their wives, and before that from Adam and Eve. But that's the problem. Many today scoff at the Bible and then point to the many different groups or races of people, including skin color, and say there's no way we can have all these different races from just eight people getting off an ark. Well, actually, thanks to modern science, we know that we can do, as this article points out in great detail.
What is a race? It is easy to think that since different groups of people have yellow skin, red skin, black skin, white skin, and brown skin, there must be many different skin pigments or colorings. And since different chemicals for coloring would mean a different genetic recipe or code in the hereditary blueprint in each people group, it appears to be a real problem. How could all those differences develop within a short time? However, we all have the same coloring pigment in our skin, melanin. This is a dark brownish pigment that is produced in different amounts in special cells in our skin. If we had none, as do people called albinos, who inherit a mutation-caused defect and cannot produce melanin, then we would have a very white or pink skin coloring. If we produced a little melanin, we would be European white. If our skin produced a great deal of melanin, we would be a very dark black. And in between, of course, are all shades of brown. There are no other significant skin pigments. In summary, from currently available information, the really important factor in determining skin color is melanin, the amount produced. This situation is true not only for skin color. Generally, whatever feature we may look at, no people group has anything that is essentially different from that possessed by any other. For example, the Asian, or almond, eye differs from a typical Caucasian eye in having more fat around them. Both Asian and Caucasian eyes have fat, the latter simply have less. What does melanin do? It protects the skin against damage by ultraviolet light from the sun. If you have too little melanin in a very sunny environment, you will easily suffer sunburn and skin cancer. If you have a great deal of melanin, and you live in a country where there is little sunshine, it will be harder for you to get enough vitamin D, which needs sunshine for its production in your body. You may then suffer from vitamin D deficiency, which could cause a bone disorder such as rickets. We also need to be aware that we are not born with a genetically fixed amount of melanin. Rather, we have a genetically fixed potential to produce a certain amount, and the amount increases in response to sunlight. For example, you may have noticed that when your Caucasian friends, who spent their time indoors during winter, headed for the beach at the beginning of summer, they all had more or less the same pale white skin color. As the summer went on, however, some became much darker than others. How is it that many different skin colors can arise in a short time? Remember, whenever we speak of different colors, we are referring to different shades of the one color, melanin. If a person from a very black people group marries someone from a very white group, their offspring, called mulattoes, are mid-brown. It has long been known that when mulattoes marry each other, their offspring may be virtually any color, ranging from very dark to very light. Understanding this gives us the answer to our question. A range of colors, from very light to very dark, can result in a single generation, beginning with this particular type of mid-brown parents. If people who are pure black, in the sense of having no genes for lightness at all, were to intermarry and migrate to a place where their offspring could not marry other people of lighter color, all their descendants would be black, a pure black line would result. If white people were to marry only other whites and migrate to a place where their offspring could not marry darker people, a pure, in the same sense, white line would result, they would have lost the genes needed to produce a large amount of melanin and be black. It is thus easily possible, beginning with two middle brown parents, to get not only all the colors, but also people groups with stable shades of skin color. But what about people groups that are permanently middle brown, such as we have today? Again, this is easily explained. If those with those certain genes no longer intermarry with others, they will be able to produce only mid-brown offspring. If either of these lines were to interbreed again with the other, the process would be reversed. In a short time, their descendants would show a whole range of colors, often in the same family. If all the people on Earth were to intermarry freely, and then break into random groups that kept to themselves, a whole new set of gene combinations could emerge. It may be possible to have almond eyes with black skin, blue eyes with black, tightly curled hair, etc. Even today, within a particular people group you will often see a feature normally associated with another people group. For instance, you will occasionally see a European with a broad flat nose, or a Chinese person with very pale skin or Caucasian eyes. Most scientists now agree that, for modern humans, race has little or no biological meaning. This also argues strongly against the idea that the people groups have been evolving separately for long periods. So let's put it all together from a biblical and scientific perspective. The first created man, Adam, from whom all other humans are descended, was created with the best possible combination of genes, for skin color, for example. A long time after creation, a worldwide flood destroyed all humans except a man called Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. This flood greatly changed the environment. Afterwards, God commanded the survivors to multiply and cover the earth, Genesis 9:1. A few hundred years later, people chose to disobey God and to remain united in building a great city, with the Tower of Babel as the focal point of rebellious worship. From Genesis 11, we understand that up to this time there was only one language. God judged the people's disobedience by imposing different languages, so that they could not work together against God. The confusion forced the people to scatter over the earth as God intended. So all the people groups, black Africans, Indo-Europeans, Mongolians, and others, have come into existence since Babel. Noah and his family were probably mid-brown, with genes for both dark and light skin, because a medium skin color would seem to be the most generally suitable, dark enough to protect against skin cancer, yet light enough to allow vitamin D production. As all the factors for skin color were present in Adam and Eve, they would most likely have been mid-brown as well, with brown eyes and brown, or black, hair. In fact, most of the world's population today is still mid-brown. After the flood, for the few centuries until Babel, there was only one language and one culture group. Thus, there were no barriers to marriage within this group. This would tend to keep the skin color of the population away from the extremes. Very dark and very light skin would appear, of course, but people tending in either direction would be free to marry someone lighter or darker than themselves, ensuring that the average color stayed roughly the same. The same would be true of characteristics other than skin color. Under these sorts of circumstances, distinct differences in appearance will never emerge. To obtain such separate lines, you would need to break a large breeding group into smaller groups and keep them separate, that is, prevent interbreeding between groups. This would be true for animal as well as human populations, as every biologist knows. This is exactly what happened at Babel. Once separate languages were imposed, there were instantaneous barriers. Not only would people tend not to marry someone they couldn't understand, but entire groups which spoke the same language would have difficulty relating to and trusting those which did not. Thus, they would move away or be forced away from each other, into different environments. This, of course, is what God intended. It is unlikely that each small group would carry the same broad range of skin colors as the original, larger group. One group might have more dark genes, on average, while another might have more light genes. The same thing would occur with other characteristics, nose shape, eye shape, etc., and since they would intermarry only within their own language group, these differences would no longer be averaged out as before. As these groups migrated away from Babel, they encountered new and different climate zones. This would also have affected the balance of inherited factors in the population. However, the effects of the environment are nowhere near as important as the initial genetic mix of each group. As an example, consider a group of people who moved to a cold region with little sunlight. Here, the dark-skinned members would not be able to produce enough vitamin D, and thus would be less healthy and have fewer children. So, in time, the light-skinned members would predominate. If several different groups went to such an area, and if one group happened to be carrying few genes for lightness, this particular group could, in time, die out. Thus, natural selection acts on the characteristics already present, and does not create new ones. It is interesting to note that the ancient Neanderthals of Europe, recognized as fully human, show evidence of vitamin D deficiency and that many of their bones were bent. In fact, this, plus a large dose of evolutionary prejudice, caused them to be classified as ape men for a long time. It is thus quite plausible that they were a dark-skinned people who were unfit for the environment into which they moved because of the skin color genes they began with. Notice, again, that this natural selection, as it is called, does not produce skin colors, but only acts on the created capacity for making skin pigment that is already there. Conversely, fair-skinned people in very sunny regions could easily be affected by skin cancer. Thus, in these regions, dark-skinned people would more readily survive and come to predominate. So we see that the pressure of the environment can, A, affect the balance of genes within this group, and, B, even eliminate entire groups. This is why we see, to a large extent, that the physical characteristics of people tend to match the environment where they live. For example, Nordic people with pale skin, equatorial people with dark skin. But this is not always so. The Inuit, Eskimo, have brown skin, yet live where there is not much sun. Presumably they all have a genetic makeup which would not be able to produce lighter skin. On the other hand, native South Americans living on the equator do not have black skin. These examples confirm that natural selection does not create new information, if the genetic makeup of a group of people does not allow variation in color toward the desirable, natural selection cannot create such variation. Pygmies live in a hot area, but rarely experience strong sunshine in their dense jungle environment, yet they have dark skin. Pygmies may be a good example of another factor that has affected the racial history of man, discrimination. People different from the norm, for example, a very light person in a dark people group, have historically been regarded as abnormal and rejected by the group. Thus, such a person would find it hard to get a marriage partner. This would further tend to eliminate light genes from a dark people, and vice versa. In this way, groups have tended to purify themselves. Also, in some instances, interbreeding within a small group can accentuate a commonly occurring unusual feature that would otherwise be swamped by marriage outside the group. There is a tribe in Africa whose members all have grossly deformed feet as a result of this inbreeding. Let us return to the pygmies. If people possessing genes for short stature were discriminated against, a small group of them might seek refuge in the deepest forest. By marrying only each other, they would ensure a pygmy race from then on. The fact that pygmy tribes do not have their own languages, but instead speak dialects of neighboring non-pygmy tribal languages, is good evidence to support this. Certain genetic characteristics may have influenced people groups to make deliberate, or semi-deliberate, choices concerning the environments to which they migrated. For instance, people with genes for a thicker, more insulating layer of fat under their skin would tend to leave areas that were uncomfortably hot. Thus, we conclude that the dispersion at Babel broke up a large interbreeding group into small, interbreeding groups. This ensured that the resultant groups would have different mixes of genes for various physical features. By itself, this dispersion would ensure, in a short time, that there would be certain fixed differences in some of these groups, commonly called races. In addition, the selection pressure of the environment would modify the existing combinations of genes so that the physical characteristics of each group would tend to suit their environment. There has been no simple to complex evolution of any genes, for the genes were present already. The dominant features of the various people groups result from different combinations of previously existing created genes, plus some minor degenerative changes, resulting from mutation, accidental changes which can be inherited. The originally created genetic information has been either reshuffled or has degenerated, but has not been added to.
Now, folks, I don't know about you, but it sure appears to me that finding this gargantuan boat is not only totally possible, and its seaworthiness is not only totally feasible, but any further questions concerning it are completely answerable. How about you? Why, if I didn't know better, I'd say there really was a guy named Noah who really did survive a global flood with his family and two of every kind of animal in a really big boat. It's like the Bible had it right all along. Go figure. Therefore, I'd say based on the evidence we just saw, there's no reason to scoff at the idea that God already judged his creation with a worldwide flood. How about you? In fact, I'd say if you persist, then I'd say you're not only willingly ignorant, but neither are you prepared for the second judgment of God that's coming sooner than you might think. Maybe you should stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ before it's too late. Isn't that what a smart person would do, right? I think so. But that's right, if you don't want to take my word for it, then please, I beg you, listen to God's.
Jude 8:2-11. In the very same way, these dreamers pollute their own bodies, reject authority and slander celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not dare to bring a slanderous accusation against him, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Yet these men speak abusively against whatever they do not understand, and what things they do understand by instinct, like unreasoning animals, these are the very things that destroy them. Woe to them! They have taken the way of Cain, they have rushed for profit into Balaam's error, they have been destroyed in Korah's rebellion.
Oh people, I beg you, please don't be like the people of Korah's rebellion so long ago. According to the word of God, they not only rejected God's authority, but they had the audacity to think their way was a better way, and so I ask you, what was the end result? They were judged. They were utterly destroyed because they rejected God's word and his way. If only they would have listened to God before it was too late. And so I ask you, what's it going to take for you two to stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ, before it's too late? As you saw in this study, God's been merciful. He's given us the evidence of a gargantuan boat to show us he judged the world once, he's going to do it again. And therefore, I beg you, like Noah did with the people of his day, please, please, won't you turn from your wicked ways? Won't you get right with God? Won't you escape the wrath to come? Won't you come into the ark? Please, this is not a game. Time is running out. The rain is going to be here before you know it, but then it'll be too late. Please, won't you accept God's offer to get saved before it's too late? And yet the Bible says that because the people of that day refused to listen to Noah, they all likewise perished. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. How about you? Are you ready? Or will you likewise perish?